Welcome to Body Matters Podcast, where we bring to you raw and inspiring content on all things to do with body positivity and eating disorder recovery.
My name's Jessie and I'll be continuing on with the podcast for a little while. But before we begin, I'd like to acknowledge Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people as traditional people and traditional owners of this country. We acknowledge with gratitude First Nations communities for their continuing care and connection to the lands or waters with which they have protected for thousands of years. We pay our respects to elders past, present, and emerging, and recognize that First Nations sovereignty was never ceded.
Hi, Kylie. Thanks for coming on the podcast.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Oh, good. So would you like to start us off by speaking about some self-care that you've done over the past week?
Yeah, I always like being outside when the weather lets me. So, you know, going for walks, going down to the beach, that's sort of a really kind of relaxing thing that I like to do quite regularly.
Yeah, I love the beach, especially in like COVID. Oh, it's been so good.
Yeah, it has been. And I think now with the weather being very rainy, you really appreciate when the weather's, you know, fine and sunny. You know, you sort of really cherish the sunny days.
You really do. So today we're going to be talking about the topic of type 2 diabetes. So what is diabetes type 2?
So type 2 is different to type 1, where type 1 is like an autoimmune disease, where your body basically attacks the cells in the pancreas that produce insulin. And insulin is really important. So when we eat food, it tends to be converted to glucose, and that goes into our bloodstream. And insulin is the hormone that's required for our glucose in our blood to be taken out of the blood and to be used by our cells. So in type 1 diabetes, we just don't have any insulin. So people who are diagnosed with type 1 have to start taking insulin multiple times a day in order for them to get any like energy and nutrients for their cells. In type 2, basically over time, people who develop type 2 diabetes tend to develop a resistance to insulin. So the body's producing insulin, but their body is less kind of able to use it. So what happens is that with time, the pancreas starts to increase more and more and more insulin. So there's more available. So the glucose can go from the bloodstream into our cells. But with time, yeah, the pancreas basically wears out. So it is a chronic progressive condition. So type 2 needs to be really managed carefully to, as much as possible, sort of manage it effectively so it doesn't progress and develop complications. So like it doesn't require insulin immediately. A lot of people can manage type 2 diabetes, at least initially, through changes to diet and exercise. They can also take other medications which are not insulin, but if it progresses and their bodies stop producing insulin or they become completely kind of resistant to it, they will need to start taking insulin injections.
So then what eating disorder presentations might be prevalent in those with type 2 diabetes?
So we tend to see all kinds of eating disorder presentations, but we tend to see higher rates of things like binge eating disorder and night eating syndrome in people with type 2 diabetes. And these are often at rates that are higher than the general population. So you do still see the occasional presentations of anorexia nervosa and bulimia nervosa, but they don't tend to be at significantly higher rates than the sort of general population.
But I have heard that more so people do experience eating disorders with diabetes.
Yeah, so there does seem to be some research suggesting that there are higher rates of eating disorders in type 1 and type 2 diabetes compared to the general population. Estimates are around sort of 10 to 40% of people could have an eating disorder and type 2 diabetes. They're really wide estimates because lots of the studies that have been done use different populations. They use different sort of instruments to assess whether someone's got an eating disorder. So we don't have really great, like really confirmed data, but certainly very clear that more people have eating disorders in diabetes than without diabetes.
Yeah, it's definitely an area that needs to be talked about.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, how might someone's previous diet be linked to the early onset and diagnosis of maybe type 2 diabetes?
So I think, I guess when we think about who's at risk for type 2 diabetes, it's really important to, I guess recognize that genetics are still the biggest risk factor. So most people who develop type 2 diabetes tend to have a family member who's had type 2 diabetes, and that is certainly one of the strongest risk factors. Ethnicity is another risk factor, and certain ethnic groups definitely have higher risks for developing type 2 diabetes and developing it earlier. When it comes to modifiable factors like diet, there is a bit of mixed information. Some studies have found some diets are associated with increased risk. So diets particularly high in processed foods and in sugars in some studies have been found to be associated with higher risk, but in other studies there's been no sort of clear association. But certainly when it comes to treatment, so when someone is diagnosed with pre-diabetes or type 2 diabetes, dietary modifications are often one of the sort of first line treatments for type 2.
But why is it also important to note that you can eat all foods within a balanced diet and not develop diabetes?
Yeah, look, I think it is a really, really important to say that everything's in balance. So, it's okay to have sometimes foods in your diet, and that includes sugary foods, because it helps us to develop a healthy relationship with food. It's just making sure that they're not the preponderance of our diet, so they're not making up the bulk of our diet.
Yes, and reducing the fear.
Yeah, there's no good or bad foods, and I think sometimes we can get a bit caught up, can't we, in thinking that, fruit and vegetables are good and anything that, has got lots of sugar in it is bad. And that's not the case. All foods have their place. Some foods have more nutritional value, some foods have more sort of fun, pleasure. So it is really important that people with diabetes are able to eat all kinds of foods. It's just being aware of how often and how much, because it does play a role in, when you eat like foods with sugar in it, you do get a big spike in glucose. And so when you've got diabetes and you have a big spike in glucose, that can, without it being managed well, can lead to ongoing high blood glucose levels. And that in turn is linked to a whole heap of complications that can come from having that. So it's just kind of having that knowledge of it's okay to have sometimes foods in moderation and managing that really well when you do have it.
And just for the general population in general, like my grandparents are in their 80s and they love their like cookies at night or something,
Yeah, I think that's actually really important. We don't just eat for nutrition and to fuel our bodies. We also eat for pleasure. We eat because it's enjoyable, it's social. So it's absolutely okay to have sometimes foods as a regular part of our diet, and that goes for people with diabetes as well.
So, how might someone with a pre-existing eating disorder struggle with diabetes type 2?
Yeah, that's a really good question, and I think that's not uncommon. A lot of people have eating disorders or like disordered eating, and so a diagnosis of diabetes can be like really quite scary and frightening, and people get quite anxious about what it means. Often when people are told they've got type 2 diabetes, they're told about all the complications that happen if you don't manage it well. So there's a lot of fear and anxiety that come with the diagnosis. And then when people are told, well, this is what you need to do to manage it, you need to lose weight, you need to watch what you eat, you need to exercise more. For someone who's got a history of an eating disorder or disordered eating, kind of having rules around food, being told to lose weight, that can be really triggering. So, if there is something that's been around for a while prior to diagnosis, the diagnosis itself and the treatment recommendations for managing diabetes can sometimes, put in place more dietary restriction, and it can lead to more rule-based eating. It can create an unhealthy relationship with our bodies, so not feeling like our bodies are good enough. So they can really, I think, play a role when someone with a pre-existing eating disorder or disordered eating gets diagnosed type 2.
Especially if someone maybe drinks like a lot of soft drink or something, like that can spike.
And I think too, when we like everyone's had the experience of, well, not everyone, but a lot of people have the experience of trying to change their diets in some way for some reason. going on a health kick, or you know, you need to do something for a physical health condition, changing your diet's really hard. And so, you know, again, if you've had an eating disorder or disordered eating before, you've probably had experience of trying to change your diet and it being really difficult and really, really hard. And, you know, so getting told that you need to lose weight and you need to watch how many carbohydrates you eat, and you know, you need to, as you said, maybe drop soft drinks, that's actually really, really tricky. And so when people, you know, are trying to say drink less soft drink, they have even a little bit, it can sometimes set up that kind of all or nothing, black and white thinking of, oh, stuff it, I've ruined it. And, you know, can then lead to actually even increased consumption of that food or that soft drink. So can be really hard, I think, to get that information at diagnosis, as well as being really worried about your health.
Because would maybe even changing your diet then cause potentially an eating disorder? Like if you're restricting, that could create binge eating disorder?
Yeah, definitely. And certainly there's that sort of, you know, the association that's been found in type 2 diabetes is that, you know, you're kind of asking people to, you know, eat less, which is dietary restriction, and to cut certain foods out of their diet or to limit them, which, you know, is kind of dietary restraint. And those two things are the known triggers for binge eating and binge eating disorder. They certainly play a role in starting it and establishing it. So, yeah, it can definitely start off an unhealthy relationship with food.
And hard for anyone who doesn't have an eating disorder, let alone someone who does.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And I think, you know, a lot of people who are diagnosed with type 2 diabetes are often living in larger bodies and have tried actually really hard to lose weight, have tried different diets, different exercise programs. And so being diagnosed with type 2 diabetes and then being told, well, you must lose weight, you know, can be really frustrating because, you know, it's something that they've tried and, you know, maybe lose some weight, but then eventually it goes back on. Okay, that can be really tricky. So yeah, it's hard to follow the advice sometimes that is, you know, a core part of management of type 2 diabetes.
Yeah, the yo-yo dieting, and that's why it's important to have the right psychological and dietetic supports.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think, you know, there's no one-size-fits-all kind of, you know, dietary plan. There are sort of some recommendations and some guidelines in terms of managing type 2 diabetes. So I think it is really important that anyone who is diagnosed, whether they've got disordered eating or not, definitely get some individualized advice around what might be helpful for them, what they feel that they can incorporate into their life, understanding their own background. So, you know, someone who has a history of disordered eating, for example, or an eating disorder, having weight goals or weight loss goals may not be a helpful focus. It might be more just on establishing regular eating, you know, focusing on the particular sort of, you know, dietary aspect initially, just to try and get into place that they might be able to actually implement successfully. So it really is important to get really good advice. And then if there is some kind of disordered eating, yeah, it's really helpful to get some support around that. So we do know that, you know, mostly the standard sort of treatments for eating disorders and disordered eating have been utilized in diabetes. So there's no really sort of specific different kind of treatment. It's more standard treatment, but it is really important that there is that dietetic support on the side, and that, you know, the psychologist and the dietitian are working really collaboratively to make sure that they're not saying anything that's sort of, you know, sending mixed messages, so that the, you know, the person is feeling really well supported and they've got really tailored, individualized advice.
So stabilizing the health side as well as the mental health side.
Absolutely, absolutely. And, you know, sometimes the sort of advice around managing diabetes can often work against some of the dietary and or psychological advice. So, you know, you've got to cut this and you've got to reach a particular target or you've got to lose weight. If there is a real history of an eating disorder, that can actually often exacerbate the eating disorder symptoms or trigger them again. And it's really important that they're managed really well. And so sometimes that means that the medical advice needs to be kind of carefully considered as to what's the priority. So sometimes having slightly higher blood glucose targets is actually okay. You know, managing you know, not having a real focus on weight loss can be really important, and just simply focusing on good health behaviors like eating a really, you know, balanced diet, you know, engaging in some exercise that's really enjoyable, kind of coming at it from that perspective rather than, you know, I've got to lose heaps of weight, or you've got to cut this out of your diet. So I think those health, having those really achievable health targets is really important.
And you're doing it to be safe as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And it's a long-term condition, so I think it's sort of, it's not just about managing it perfectly right now. It's about finding ways to kind of manage it in a really balanced way for the rest of your life. So I think that's important too, because I think if you're just sort of looking at, oh, I've just got to get all this right now, often, you know, we're sort of not seeing it as something that we're going to have to just kind of be constantly working with and evolving as time goes by.
Trying to find the best way of living that's adapted to your lifestyle.
Yeah, absolutely. There's that, you know, whether so that kind of one size fits all thing, like there is no such thing. So, you know, any chronic health condition, it comes down to how to manage it best within a person's own, you know, life and sort of, you know, how what's going on for them.
Yes, it's more like the day-to-day approach and the little things.
I think so. Working out what's important, how to put it in place, and then how to maintain it is this sort of, I think, a really, really important thing for anyone who's got any kind of chronic health condition.
And it's like, what can you do? How can you progress in your own situation?
Absolutely. And I think that's sort of, you know, it's a lot of stuff that's not in your control when you've got a chronic health condition, you know. So the things that you can control, it's important to be really balanced with that. And I think it can be really easy to frame things as, like, you know, as we talked before about being good or bad. I'm going really good today. I did X, Y, and Z. And so, you know, that kind of framing can often be a bit unhelpful because we don't do things at that level, you know, we then go, it's bad. The reality is, you know, we just got to be trying to work towards the things that are important as best as we can. But every day is going to vary a bit, isn't it? Some days where we're, you know, we're sort of getting close to where we want to be. Other days, well, other things are happening, and so it doesn't quite happen. But it's not the end of the world because we're looking at it over a long period of time.
Especially if things happen out of your control.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and focusing on the stuff that you control and the stuff you can't. Sometimes there will be days where you might have really high blood sugar and there's no rhyme or reason to it, right? You've eaten the same kind of thing, you've, you know, done a bit of exercise, you've slept okay, you know, and they're really high. You know, another day they're perfect and you did none of the things that you normally do. That's kind of the reality of living with a chronic health condition, is that you don't have perfect control. So there's only some parts of it and how it's, you know, it's managed that you do have control of. And we do know that actually, you know, people with type 2 diabetes get into a kind of good routine of seeing their GP regularly, you know, taking the medications that they've been prescribed, you know, finding a dietary approach that works best for them, and, you know, trying to do a bit of exercise again that they enjoy and that fits into their lifestyle, that it can actually be managed really successfully and people can stave off complications from diabetes. So it is something that can be successfully managed, and, you know, with all the things that also aren't in our control.
It is, over the long term as well.
Yeah, that's sort of something I think that's really important in treatment, is kind of framing goals, you know, not just about the short-term ones, which are really important, but also about this is something that's going to find a way to best manage.
New adjustments.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, finding a way to adjust, and it moves, right? Because it's a progressive condition. There might be multiple adjustments across the sort of the course of the condition.
And exploring new things, do you like books? Are you interested in these things? You may find you like sitting outside a lot more than you thought.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's, you know, the great thing about this wonderful world we're living in is that things are progressing all the time. So just learning about what works, you know, for you as an individual, but all the interventions, the medical treatments are also rapidly improving.
That's true. So, how might diabetes type 2 affect different cultures?
Yeah, it's a really good question. So I guess, certain ethnic backgrounds do lead to an increased risk of developing type 2 diabetes. So people who are from Asian descent, African and Caribbean descent tend to have an increased risk of developing type 2 diabetes, and they tend to be at risk at a younger age than people who don't come from those ethnic backgrounds. Indigenous Australians and Torres Strait Islanders are also at increased risk. We don't really know why. Like it's sort of an area we don't really understand why, but there's an increased sort of genetic risk of developing them. So that's, I guess, one way it affects people of different cultures. I guess in terms of treatment, I guess when you think about cultural groups with such different understandings of illness, what causes illness, for some ethnic groups, they place a lot more, I guess, personal attribution to it. So in other words, like it's a person's own fault or their own responsibility for illness, whereas other cultural groups may be less likely to do that. Different cultures eat really differently too. So, when you think about the Caribbean diet, for example, it's highly rice-based. So, that can actually be really tricky for people trying to manage diabetes when they're having to sort of think about managing the carbohydrate intake. So that might make it harder to change the diet in the family, might make it harder for social or cultural celebrations. So there's lots of, I think, really, big impacts in terms of culture.
Yeah, definitely, because I know community is a big part of a lot of cultures as well, and that socialization is so important. Food is so valued in meaning.
Yeah, it is. It is. So, I think in some communities they're more accepting of, type 2 diabetes, whereas other cultures and communities are less. And I think for some people, they can feel quite stigmatized for having diabetes. I guess there is a bit of a stereotype in our society in Australia that, people who develop type 2 diabetes are to blame. There's sort of a sense of personal culpability because I think there is a perception that people who develop type 2 diabetes are, they ate the wrong things, or maybe they gained too much weight, or they're not active enough. So that can really lead to a lot of more blame and shame, and it really underplays or diminishes the genuine contributions of genes and genetics. And so that's really hard if you're feeling to blame for a condition that you didn't choose and you don't want. That can be really tricky. And I think it can lead people to, sometimes avoid seeing others and spending time in their communities.
So, how does treatment aim to introduce regular eating patterns alongside insulin administration?
Yeah, so, obviously, insulin's a hormone that allows glucose to go from our bloodstream into our cells. So, eating regularly and then taking an appropriate dose of insulin afterwards is really important, actually, to kind of nourish our bodies and our brains and make sure, we're healthy and functioning at our optimum. So, yeah, a real really important goal of treatment is, to help people to normalize eating in terms of eating regularly, eating sufficiently, spreading their energy across the day. And if someone's taking insulin, then yeah, making sure they're taking it and they're taking the appropriate dose to ensure that their energy needs are being met.
Yes, life-saving treatment.
Yeah. And I guess that's somewhere we do see, unfortunately, disordered eating behaviors creep in. So it's not uncommon for people to either take less insulin than they need, or not take insulin for the purposes of wanting to lose weight or maintain a low body weight. So that is, a disordered eating behavior that does come up uniquely in diabetes. And so I guess it's really important to help people understand the consequences of that. So if you don't take enough insulin, or you don't take insulin, then the sugar, the glucose in your blood isn't actually being used by your cells. So you're going to be really tired and lethargic. thirsty, dizzy, lightheaded, but it also unfortunately leads to some of the complications that come from diabetes. So that can lead to, you know, issues with your kidneys, your eyes, your nerves. So it's really risky actually not taking enough insulin, because it's kind of, I guess, makes those complications come about much earlier.
Definitely. So what about physical health conditions or chronic pain? How does it impact someone differently with an eating disorder?
Yeah, it's a really good question. Look, I think chronic health conditions really have a massive impact on someone who's already struggling with, you know, a psychiatric illness that has physical and emotional impacts. So, you know, a lot of conditions can interact. So, you know, if you're feeling really unwell, that can, you know, really affect your mental health, can't it? So, you know, it plays a role in not, you know, increasing things like feeling more depressed, feeling more burdened by the illness, more anxious about what's going on. It can play a role in, you know, eating. So some physical health conditions can really affect our appetite, making us more or less hungry, and that can really sort of be really difficult if you're also trying to manage an eating disorder concurrently. Some of the treatments, you know, can play a role, can't they, in terms of affecting sort of, you know, whether we need to be eating at certain times or eating certain things. So I think they have really quite significant overlay. It's really, really hard to kind of disentangle sometimes some of the impacts of one or the other, but certainly they can compound things, yeah.
Especially with the treatments for like cancer, I know it can really tire you out and you can't go in the sun. So then like it really impacts, you know, if you're able to engage in exercise, or depending on what the condition is, if you're mobile enough during times, you want to go out and do things, but you're a bit tired.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, if the physical implications are huge, aren't they? If you're managing a condition with really, you know, intensive treatments, might make it really hard then to do some of the things you might want to do for relaxation or coping or social activities. And that in turn then doesn't help if you've got an eating disorder, because it's already exacerbating parts of life that are really tricky. You know, for some people they might not be able to use food and eating as a coping strategy. It's not available, so it might make it really hard to cope in, you know, with what they're going through.
All sudden diagnosis from someone who may have had a previous history of an eating disorder, it may trigger everything if, you know, they're suddenly immobile for a certain amount of time.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So, yeah, you can sort of appreciate that someone who's been, you know, doing really well and in remission, they have some news that really changes their existing coping strategies and they're not necessarily able to utilize them. I mean, it's a terribly difficult thing to manage, but you know, it certainly could trigger things for somebody again. Yeah.
Yes, and that's why it's important to reach out for support.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I think, you know, the sort of the message with, you know, eating disorders and diabetes is I think that sometimes they're not necessarily seen as, you know, disordered eating. You know, some people are trying to make these changes to their diet and really struggling and might be engaging in overeating or binge eating and aren't necessarily always identified as having disordered eating, but it is really important to get the help to be able to normalize eating again and to be able to then get on track with diabetes management. And I think that's the same for any chronic condition, that, you know, the psychologist or social worker or counselor, dietitian, GP specialist, and you know, everyone has a slightly different role to play in sort of how to support somebody. Because when you think about particularly type one, because it's the treatment's so intensive, they typically have an endocrinologist who they see quite regularly. They'll have their GP, they might have a dietitian occasionally, depending on what's going on. They might have a diabetes nurse or a diabetes educator somewhere in their team. And then if they've got, you know, a psychologist for psychological issues, you've already got five people. And if they're not eating disorder informed, then you've got really sometimes very varied treatment goals. You know, so I've worked on teams where, you know, the dietitian's saying, don't eat any carbohydrates. And I'm, you know, in the background, you know, my session's going, it's really important that we have all foods, and I can see from your food logs that you don't have any carbohydrates, and then I notice in the afternoon you binge on carbohydrates. Right. So, we really need to introduce some carbohydrates into the day so that they're not feared foods, that we can have them all the time. So you kind of see the challenge, can't you, of having people really sending very mixed messages.
And it's really hard because carbohydrates is your brain's primary source of
Yeah.
energy. So if you take that away,
Yeah. And so again, the recommendations for people with type 2 diabetes is that you can still have carbohydrates. You just need to be mindful of spreading them throughout the day, trying to pick the low GI options, so the ones that tend to break down slower. So instead of the idea behind low GI foods is that when they're broken down, it takes longer to break down. So the glucose going into your bloodstream is more distributed rather than, high GI foods where your body breaks it down very quickly and then it goes straight out into your bloodstream. So people with diabetes are recommended to just focus on more of the low GI foods. So that's more like wholemeal pastas, wholemeal breads, brown rice, things like that. So it's not that they advise don't have any carbohydrates. It's more just about spreading them throughout the day and having more of the whole grain, wholemeal versions, which is still can be really tricky for people to do.
yeah.
It's not necessarily an easy adjustment.
No. Maybe you should try find like maybe healthier versions then of the foods you like. Can you cook? Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's just, as you said, it's finding adaptations. Like for some people, it's a real sticking point to get rid of something out of their diet because they just love it and they crave it when it's gone. So it might be for that person, for example, let's just say it's chocolate. It might be going, okay, it's okay to have some chocolate every day. You've just got to be work out what's sort of the right amount that works for you. And then, having that every day in the context of a balanced diet. Because if they give it up, then they're going to potentially feel really deprived and really crave it. And then when they do eventually have it, they feel like they failed and it might set up a binge where they go, oh, well, stuff it. I've ruined it for today. May as well eat heaps and then I'll be good tomorrow. And, as we know, that can then set up a real, really unhealthy relationship where you're kind of avoiding it and then binging on it.
And food is really emotional as well, you know.
Yeah.
So, how can you best support someone who may be struggling with their mental health after a health diagnosis, illness, or injury?
Yeah, I think that's a really good question. I think that, we want to support our family and friends or colleagues who are going through tough times, and we certainly know people need support. I think it's really important to ask somebody, how can I help you? I think some people prefer to be helped, and some people prefer to be a bit more independent. Also, people often have preferences of how they like to be helped or what they need. So for some people, they just want to have a distraction. They just want to have a friend who just, they can just be distracted from whatever's going on. For some people, they really like, the really practical things that people can offer, like making them a meal or mowing their lawns or driving them to appointments. Other people really like just having someone they can talk to about it and share how they're feeling. So I think it's really important that we let our friends and family know that we're there for them and we want to help them and, ask how they'd like to be supported would be my advice.
Especially if you are experiencing something, you need to talk about it.
And some people, like to talk to lots of people. Some people only like to talk to a very small, number of people. So not everyone will want to talk about it in great detail, but it is always lovely to know, isn't it, that people are there for us if we're going through a tough time. And I think just checking in, occasionally checking in, letting someone know that you're there for them, wanting to know how they're going, I think it's really important.
And I think there needs to be a little bit more mental health support for those who have had an eating disorder and experience an injury. You know, I feel like there's a bit of a gap there.
Yeah, and I think too, as you raised before, that if someone has a history of an eating disorder or disordered eating and something really difficult comes up, something really adverse in their lives, it can be a really risky time in terms of perhaps lapsing or relapsing. And so, being able to sort of be there for someone and recognizing it's really tough. is really important, and not assuming just because they might look okay that everything's okay, because it isn't always the case.
Sometimes the emotional stuff, you know.
And we know that, for a lot of people with eating disorders or disorder eating, it's not visible. So people can think everything's okay, but it's still really not great. So I think it's really important that we don't assume based on sort of what we can see that someone's doing okay.
So then, what is acceptance therapy, and how can acceptance therapy provide skills maybe around mindfulness practice?
Really good question. So acceptance and commitment therapy is a treatment approach that's often been applied in like chronic sort of conditions or people with sort of physical health issues where, it's not necessarily going to improve or heal or get better. So I guess it's sort of kind of the title sort of tells us a bit about what it's about. So it's sort of based on the idea that, it's really helpful to accept the things that are out of our control, that we can't really do anything about those, and then turn our attention and our commitment to the things that will help us live our best lives. And so there's a number of, I guess, tools in acceptance and commitment therapy. So you talked about mindfulness, and mindfulness is a really important skill around acceptance. So when we practice mindfulness, it's, I guess, at heart, it's really about being in the present, in the here and now, but with a non-judgmental stance. In other words, we're just kind of accepting what's going on. We're not judging it. So that means accepting our emotions, accepting our thoughts, and not being judgmental of them. And so when we're practicing mindfulness, we're really being here in the here and now. And we can practice sort of not being too caught up in our thoughts and in our head and in the things that are bothering us. And when we're in the here and now, it also gives us the opportunity to focus on that sort of committed action. So doing the things that are really aligned with our values and doing the things that we can change to enable us to kind of, lead our best lives, even while accepting that we've got this sort of chronic thing that's going on for us that may in some ways impede the things that we want to achieve, but we can still move forward.
And taking it day by day, while like looking for the good things as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. You sort of sound like you're talking about gratitude a bit there.
Oh, gratitude's so important. Also holding on to a sense of hope as well, when things are really challenging during those times.
Yeah. And I think sometimes when things are, it can feel really hopeless. That's when our supports can be really, really helpful, because sometimes we need other people to hold hope for us when we don't feel like there's hope. Sometimes we need our friends or our family or our treatment team to be really confident and committed that things will get better, even when we're not in that space ourselves.
And you might be surprised, the things that come out of all the good things you're trying to implement.
Yeah, absolutely. Might not see it today or tomorrow, but with time, you're absolutely right. I think that, we can then look back and kind of see, oh yeah, that did get better. Oh yeah, I did do that. Yeah, so it is important, I think. And I think that's where, mindfulness is something that we can, if we're in the present and we're attending to things like what we can see, what we can hear, what we can smell, we can also manipulate that. So we go out into a place we really like and see the things we like and hear the things that we like and smell the things that, make us feel happy. So we've got the capacity to, put ourselves in situations that even temporarily improve things for us.
So, how can you maybe not internalize the impact that your health condition may have on family members?
Yeah, gosh, that's a loaded question. That's a tricky one.
That statement before.
That's a complex one. How do you not internalize the impact on your family? Look, I think nobody chooses to get a health condition, right? And no one would bring it on themselves. No one chooses it. It's no one's fault. And I think that's really important to remember, both from your own position, but also your family and your loved ones. So no one chooses to get type 2 diabetes. No one chooses to live with it. It's no one's fault. I think that's a really important place to start from. But I do think that we do internalize things, don't we? Like, it's, you know, if you think that, you know, it's your fault that you got something or you brought something about, it's very hard then not to internalize it and then to assume that other people are going to think the same way. So, you know, I think education around understanding, you know, illnesses is really important, and that's really important for someone when they're diagnosed with it. I think people underplay genetic contributions to things. The reality is our genes dictate nearly everything, and that includes developing any kind of illness. So I think that education really plays a role. I think empathy is really important. So, you know, if you were thinking about, you know, oh, I'm to blame, and then you thought about a really dear, loved friend or family member, you know, would you blame them? Would you hold them accountable? Most people wouldn't. So, you know, if we wouldn't do it to someone else, then why are we doing it to ourselves? So empathy is really important. And I think as a family member, putting yourself in the shoes of the person who has to live with that chronic condition, that's a really tough gig, you know. No one would necessarily choose that or want that. You know, I think if we can sort of stop and pause, so, you know, someone might be, you know, grumpy or irritable because they're in pain, say, or they're having a tough day with whatever they're going through. And it can be really easy, can't it, in the moment to snap back and be grumpy and irritable too. So I think sort of recognizing that this is coming from the fact that they're having a really tough time helps us to be a little bit more compassionate. And to, you know, perhaps sort of before we react, kind of go, oh, hang on a minute, they're going through some stuff. Maybe I just need to cut them some slack a little bit.
Yeah.
Or even just kind of saying, how are you going? Like, it's, you know, you're having a good day, having a tough day. Understanding maybe that there's something that's sitting behind, you know, that irritability or grumpiness.
So do you have any other advice then for anyone who may be struggling with an eating disorder and health condition or health diagnosis?
Look, I really think it might be a bit scary, you know, talking to your healthcare providers, but I do think it's really important to let them know that you might be struggling with disordered eating or an eating disorder. Often, you know, it can make things harder for you if you don't let them know. They might be giving advice that normally they wouldn't if they knew that you had some kind of disordered eating or eating disorder. So I think it really is important to reach out to your healthcare team and, you know, let them know, or at least let one of the members know, and so that they can kind of inform the rest of the team and help to get the right support and the right people around to support you going through that. You know, eating disorders within the context of chronic health conditions, you know, can really make things, you know, harder and more tricky for the person who's kind of living with those conditions. And so making sure that people are informed and giving the right advice and there is the right support there is really important. So that would be my advice, is just to let someone know what's going on in the team.
Well, thank you so much, Kylie, for this interview.
Pleasure. Thank you for having me. Bye.
Bye.
Well, that's the end of today's episode. Please subscribe, leave us a comment or a review. If you would also like to learn more about Body Matters services, you can check out our website at bodymatters.com.au. Thanks for listening.